We'll hear arguments first this morning in McDonough Power Equipment Company against Greenwood. Mr. Patterson, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this is an appeal from a mandate of the Tenth Circuit which ordered a new trial in a product liability personal injury suit in which the verdict and the resultant judgment were for the defendant. At the trial level, fault was allocated to non-parties under a procedure that is governed by Kansas law and fashioned under the federal rules of civil procedure, where there really was quite a tight merger between the federal rule of procedure and the substantive law of Kansas. A special verdict was returned in order to accommodate that situation. There was a finding in which damages were also found under that procedure. The ground for new trial was what the Tenth Circuit described as an impairment to the use of a peremptory challenge. In order to properly focus upon the precise issue, I believe it can best be accomplished by describing very briefly what the case is not. It is not a case of juror misconduct. The Tenth Circuit found the juror, in responding to the voir dire questions, was honest and in good faith. It is not a question of juror qualification or the lack of the statutory qualifications. There was not a denial of a hearing to determine whether or not actual bias existed. No hearing was granted, no hearing was requested after the court permitted an interview with the juror by both counsel simultaneously over the telephone. Subsequent to that interview, there was no hearing requested. There was no trial error that was identified. We have the unusual situation of, as was described in the brief, of a wrong without a wrongdoer. It was not a case of a denial of a peremptory challenge itself. Each side was given three. It was a two-party case. The contention and the ruling of the circuit was that a peremptory challenge was impaired due to the lack of a level of information which counsel had at the time the peremptory challenge had to be exercised. In order to focus upon that, I think it is necessary to subdivide and identify three more separate issues which are really the substance of my argument. The first is what I have denominated the right to know argument. Is there or should there be a level of information to which counsel are entitled that is over and above that which is provided by good faith, honest answers to proper voir dire questions? The Tenth Circuit held that there was that level of information. It was described by the Tenth Circuit as that level of information that would be provided by the, quote, average, end of quote, juror. That's the only description we have. That's the only description of the standard that we must meet.
You're saying then, Mr. President, that the Tenth Circuit went beyond requiring the juror to, in good faith, answer the question as he understood
it. Yes, sir. That is precisely the point. Secondly,
does that theory in any way allow the counsel not to be diligent in his questioning?
Does not prohibit counsel from asking any question, Your Honor, on a voir dire.
Does it also allow him not to ask questions?
As it was implemented in this case, no, sir. Rule 47, of course, gives the court leeway either way. The court can ask all questions on voir dire. He can permit counsel to ask questions on voir dire, or there can be a combination of both. In this case, both was done.
Is the duty of counsel recognized, a duty to probe properly?
Our contention is that that is the responsibility of counsel.
And not of the court?
I'm sorry, sir?
I'm sorry to get at you. I mean, is that is the duty of the counsel.
We suggest that it is, sir.
And now, if any time, is it your position that counsel in this case could have asked a question which would have brought out this information?
I think it could have been done. It could have been responded to in the answer in the questions that were asked. Our position is that the fact that it does not and did not does not show dishonesty on the part of the juror, and neither does it show a lack of good faith, and the Tenth Circuit observed that. What the Tenth Circuit did rule was that counsel was entitled to a level of information beyond good faith, honest answers.
Well, it said that, said that it was entitled to the kind of an answer that the average juror would have given.
Yes, sir.
And then the average juror would have understood that he should have revealed the information that he didn't reveal.
That is the standard that we seek to challenge.
Mr. Patterson, just for a minute, may we return to the conversation, the post-trial conversation between counsel?
Yes, sir.
The judge did not participate in that, did he?
Yes, sir. That was granted.
The judge heard the telephone conversation between counsel.
It happened in this sequence, Your Honor. Early or after the trial, there was a motion filed for leave to approach juror. We have a blanket rule in the district following the trial of the Kirkwood Silkwood Kerr McGee case, which absolutely prohibits counsel from interrogating any juror after a trial without the court's permission. No juror contact was made. Application was made by plaintiff's counsel, and initially it was denied. Soon thereafter, a second application was made in which there was an accompanying affidavit of the father of the plaintiff. The plaintiff was a 3-year-old child. The father was a Navy recruiter. He could recall the name of a person in Olpe, Kansas, which I should explain is a rather small community in Kansas of about 300, who had the same surname as did the foreman of the jury. It happened that there was an 18-year-old boy who had received an injury, a broken leg, in the course of inflating a tire. We don't know much about the mechanics of the injury, how it happened, what it involved, or the seriousness of the injury.
I was interested in the conversation between
right.
the two counsel
thereafter,
after the trial.
The court sustained counsel's motion, granted permission to have the telephone interview occur. It did, in fact, occur. It was off the record. No,
the judge was not a party to that conversation.
No, sir, he was not.
But is there any difference of opinion as to what transpired in that conference?
Well, I'd say we agreed on about 70% of it. In the counsel's brief before the Tenth Circuit, he placed what he recalled, and I placed what I recalled. And
can we accept what the Tenth Circuit said about the substance of the conversation?
The Tenth Circuit said that they gave full credence to both versions.
Can we accept it?
I believe so. I'm not going to contend or object to what was said by counsel in his brief in the Tenth Circuit.
May I ask right there?
Yes.
I was puzzled about the extent to which that conversation was reported to the district judge.
It was never reported to the district judge. That's the point.
Not even on the subsequent motion for a new trial?
No, sir.
So that there was information about that conversation that was made known to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals thought dispositive, which had not been made known to the district court.
That is the reason for my initial comment that this was a trial without error. That's true. The conversation was never reported to the trial court. He never ruled on it.
In the Court of Appeals, did you object to the fact that you were then arguing about the significance of a conversation that had not been disclosed to the district court?
It was both orally and in the briefs.
I see.
And it was something that occurred entirely off the record. I'm going to get back to that and a point that's farther down in my argument, which raises the question of whether or not there should be presumed prejudice. That point is absence, or is the evidence, I believe, of the absence of prejudice, the fact that it was not reported to the trial court so that the trial court could then schedule a hearing to determine actual bias. It was not done.
Let me ask this, because I've missed something here. You say the rule in your district is that there can't be any interrogation of jurors. Did the court consent to it here?
Well, yes. The rule provides, Your Honor, that there cannot be any contact of jurors post-trial without the permission of the court. It was initially denied. Later it was granted, but limited to one juror, who was identified, Juror Payton. He happened to be the foreman. The court outlined the method by which it was to be done. It said it could be done, but both counsel had to be present, and it could be done by means of a conference telephone call, and which it was.
Nothing said about recording the call.
No, sir. Nothing was said in the order, and unfortunately, it was not done. But
well, I understand from what you said earlier, nothing turns on what was said in that conversation.
Well, I think it does turn, Your
something
Honor.
Something does?
Yes, I think something does turn, because that...
There's no dispute about what was said in the sense
right.
that
that's right.
We can rely on what the Court of Appeals said was said.
That's right. That's right. I believe there was no difference of opinion about what was said.
Mr. Patterson, didn't the district court decide that the trial had been fair, and wasn't that decision made after this discussion as to whether or not the juror should have disqualified himself?
In the sequence of events, that is what occurred. The motion for new trial, if I recall correctly, and I could be off a day or two, but the motion for new trial was actually filed, I believe, on the same day that the telephone conversation occurred. Impairment of a peremptory challenge was not one of the grounds for new trial urged. Ground number 18 comes close to it, and the error identified there was the refusal of the trial court to permit inquiry among jurors to determine whether or not juror misconduct had occurred. That, the Tenth Circuit said, was broad enough to include the ground upon which new trial was granted by the Tenth Circuit, the denial of a peremptory challenge.
You lost me there. Let's get a time straight. They filed a motion for new trial on approximately the same day of this telephone conversation.
Yes, sir.
And the motion for new trial made no mention of the telephone conversation.
That's true. It's printed in the appendix. And the order...
Could I ask you if the... suppose the juror had answered the question in a way that revealed the information that was later brought out about the accident to his son.
Yes, sir.
Would there have been any basis for challenging the juror for cause?
I doubt it. That is
I
really
suppose counsel would have asked the judge to excuse, might have asked the judge to excuse him for cause.
It might have occurred, but that is a judgment call of the trial court, and I really couldn't presume to answer that question. Because, you see, it would be a matter of challenge for cause. And under the rules, that's determined by the trial judge alone. It might be requested. That's a judgment.
Was there any
the
evidence one way or another as to whether if the answer had been the full answer and included the information that was later brought out, was there any evidence one way or another as to whether or not counsel would have exercised a peremptory challenge?
We believe there was, Your Honor, because two other jurors revealed similar type information.
And he did not challenge.
They were not challenged. They both sat. And
so
the record, they
but
can,
that's all there is. There was no, certainly there couldn't have been any, there wasn't any hearing as to whether he would or would not have exercised
it. No, sir. There was none.
But the Court of Appeals assumed that there that he should have had the information so as to make up his mind about
the
using
court,
his peremptory challenge.
The Court of Appeals, in one sentence, held that bias as well as prejudice were conclusively presumed. The sentence was to the effect that if the undisclosed information is of sufficient cogency to cause us to believe counsel was entitled to know of it when peremptory challenge was exercised. That, you see, in one sentence, conclusively presumes bias, conclusively presumes prejudice so as to remove the case from the harmless error rule identified in 28.
I understand that they're saying about prejudice, but how would they conclusively presume bias?
How they did it and why, I cannot answer. They appeared to do so.
Mr. Patterson, if the situation were such that the information the juror failed to disclose was information that clearly under anyone's view, would have constituted grounds for a challenge for cause of that juror. Would you feel that a new trial would have to be granted?
It depends upon whether or not the information, I would suppose, whether or not the information was called for in the voir dire question that was asked. Clearly.
Well, let's assume it was.
If it was, then it would be a case of misconduct. That would be a, that would
all right,
be a matter
of misconduct. All right, now what if it wasn't called for? But clearly the information would have given grounds to challenge for cause. You would say no new trial.
Well, that, again, I think would fall into the category of information that was might have been obtainable had a question been asked but was not otherwise obtained for the failure to lack to
so
ask the question.
So you would say that would be waived?
That would be waived. That would be counsel's responsibility, not misconduct on the part of the juror or any mistake of the trial court.
Well, it seems to me that the information let's assume the information would have been clearly grounds for challenge for cause, but the juror didn't answer and give that information. I would suppose he might honestly have thought that the question didn't call for that information, and which everybody agrees in this case was the case. But nevertheless, an average juror, objectively, would have given the answer.
That is the rule that the Tenth Circuit announced. That's the rule that we seek to challenge here, Your Honor.
Well, all right. Let's assume that the average, that anybody in his right mind would have given the full answer. But nevertheless, this particular person honestly didn't give it. He was honest. He wasn't engaged in misconduct. It's just that he didn't reveal this information, although the average juror would have. Would you then say a new trial was?
No, sir, I would not. I would say then that the court was adding to the qualifications of jurors beyond that which Congress authorized in 28 U.S.C. 1865 B2. You see, you're announcing a standard. You're announcing a required level of performance of a juror, which might be beyond and might require a comprehension and skill in the use of comprehending the English language in the first place, recalling events rapidly in the scene of a courtroom, because these questions very often have no time limits to them, recalling all of the events that pass through the bulk of their life, and thirdly, an ability to accurately relate that information. That involves some skills in the use of the English language. Now, the only statutory requirement is that he has to be sufficiently skilled in, to fill out the jury form. We suggest this, that questions asked on voir dire are bound to be understood differently as long as you have jurors that come from all walks of society. And that indeed is the policy. It's mandated by statute and probably by decisions that preceded the statute, 28 U.S.C. 1861 through 65. You have a cross-section of the community. You have all ages, all occupational groups, all social and economic status groups, both sexes, all races. We suggest that that diverse group will not comprehend all questions in exactly the same manner.
Would you have challenged if the Court of Appeals had sent the case back for a hearing in the district court? With respect to prejudice or bias?
Very likely not. We would have held the hearing and gone from there.
Because of the so you wouldn't say the fact that the juror was honest necessarily precluded a hearing with respect to whether a peremptory challenge would have been exercised or not, or whether there was actual bias by the juror?
Well, I would have been concerned about it, Your Honor, but I would have doubted in my own mind whether the case in that posture would be the proper vehicle to present the question here that we're presenting now.
What would have been the scope of the hearing if there had been such a remand with respect to bias? Would they actually get into what went on in the jury room?
Hopefully not. Because that's absolutely prohibited by Rule 606.
Yes.
No, it would be a question of whether or not the prior events that he was inquired about had such an impact upon his attitude and his thinking that he had already prejudged this type of case.
Well, you would have to just decide, could you call him to the stand?
More than likely.
And so you would, but
but avoid anything that went on in the jury room or the impact of any bit of information.
So it would have to
have
be sort of an inferential conclusion.
It would have to be. We know of no other way.
The inquiry would be confined to the inquiry that could have been made at the trial, at the selection of the jury?
Well, the inquiry would be limited
to whether or not he's had a state of mind that might have come close to prejudging the issues prior to the time he heard any evidence on it. That would be it. That's what I understand by the term actual bias. Certainly it could not involve anything that went on in the jury room. That's prohibited.
In your research, have you come across any case close to this one?
We have attempted to. The problem has come up, Your Honor, and it has come up in most of the circuits. We find that the
I'm talking about extending the rule.
The circuits have held that this is not a ground for new trial unless there is either juror misconduct or a finding of actual bias and a finding of actual prejudice.
That's what I said. Is there one like this?
We have found none. We have found none, Your Honor, that does this, nor have we found any that sets up a standard which required a standard of the, quote, average, end of quote, juror, which requires a minimum standard.
We would just be putting down a rule based on a case that's unique in its own facts.
Well, I wouldn't say that the facts are unique. It's really quite typical. I think the rule of the Tenth Circuit is what is unique. Yes, sir.
But you seem to agree, or you wouldn't have objected to a remand. Rather than an order for new trial. And suppose at that hearing, which you seem to think could be based on the fact that this juror, although he was honest, didn't give this information that on voir dire. Suppose at the hearing the district judge determined, based on all the evidence, that counsel would have exercised a peremptory challenge to exclude this juror.
That's a finding of prejudice, and we would be bound by it.
And now, there would be then it would be in a new trial?
Certainly.
Because of an interference with a peremptory challenge?
No.
What?
Well, I think let me identify the steps of our analysis first. I do not think that we get into this problem of a hearing on actual bias or actual prejudice until you first make this initial concession that there is a level of performance that the court can require.
That's why I...
We object to that.
Well, I know. Well, and you should object to... You should say you would be here making the same kind of an argument if there had been a remand rather than for a hearing rather than an order for a new trial.
We probably would have gone that route rather than raising the question with a case in that posture as being the vehicle to raise this question. But we're not in that posture. We do raise the question of whether or not there should be that kind of a requirement.
The appellee used up all of his challenges, peremptories?
All parties used all three challenges.
Well, what good would that do here? He would have exercised his peremptory. What peremptory?
No.
He didn't have any.
All three challenges were used. The contention, Your Honor, is that he was required to use his peremptory challenges at a time when he lacked information to which he was entitled. Our question is, or our contention is, that he is entitled to that information that is provided by honest, good faith answers of an ironman. But nothing more, and nothing more should be required. That's about all you can ask.
To what extent is there a questionnaire available to counsel to all members of the array of prospective jurors?
Well, the court, if I recall the events properly, the court asked some very general questions initially.
I'm speaking of a written questionnaire. Is that in vogue in your parts?
I believe, yes, it is. And there was no question raised by either side about the ability or lack of ability.
Was there a question in there about accidents of people in your own family?
I believe not. I believe not, because not every case is a damage case. They come there to hear criminal cases, damage suits, and anything that they have before them.
There are questionnaires which reach all of those points, though.
I haven't looked at it for 3.5 years, and I honestly don't recall.
Mr. Patterson, do I understand your position to be that if a juror intentionally refuses to disclose information that is directly asked on voir dire, that there should be a new trial granted?
That really involves a question of misconduct.
Now, yes, well, let us assume an intentional refusal to disclose information that's asked. Now, does that automatically result in a new trial?
Not automatically, no, ma'am. I think you have the additional...
What would determine it, then?
The additional question of whether or not there is actual bias and actual prejudice. You see, otherwise...
Okay, so juror misconduct, then, is not really a factor.
Not per se.
The thing that you would have us focus on is the probable bias.
Probable bias and also prejudice in order to get away and satisfy the harmless error rule, which is announced in 28 U.S.C. 2111 and also in Rule 61, Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Misconduct in the abstract by itself really doesn't do it unless in order to satisfy the harmless error rule. I would say in all candor that the Fourth Circuit did in one case, in a case in which they found misconduct on the part of the juror, from that presumed prejudice. Bias was not considered, so I don't know. I've used more than my time, and I'm sorry.
Mr. Schwarer?
May it please the Court. Our theory is based upon the fact that there is a distinct difference between the kind of misconduct that's involved when either an outside person or a person in the jury, after the jury has been selected and heard the case, as distinguished from the kinds of right to information to which the plaintiff is entitled or the defendant is entitled during questions to voir dire men. Now, in Kansas, we selected 12 jurors to sit in a panel, in an array, and after all the questions were over, first by the court and then by counsel, we each exercised three peremptory challenges. It wasn't done voir dire men by voir dire men.
Well, what is the ultimate number of the jury you end
six
up with?
Six at that time. So we each, by putting 12 in the box, there were six remaining after three peremptories were exercised. We don't waive peremptories in Kansas, and the court asks preliminary questions, general, vague, broad questions about job, employment, where you work, where your wife works, and then allows counsel to conduct independent voir dire. The whole point of this case, and we believe the Tenth Circuit's right in the cases that preceded our case, is the fact that it's a meaningless right to have three peremptories if the lawyers don't get truthful information from the jurors. Other circuits...
You say truthful, Mr. Schwarer. Do you mean non-false information from the point of view of the person answering, or kind of objectively truthful?
Perhaps I should have said full and complete rather than suggesting truthful versus untruthful. This is a case where, as the Tenth Circuit said, any reasonable juror would have responded. There were some five or six other questions asked by counsel for, first by the judge in the general text of, can you be fair? Would you be a fair juror if you were representing a plaintiff in this case? And do you think you'd be fair if you'd be the kind of juror the defendant would want in this case?
Has any bearing on which point you're making now?
I think it has a bearing only in the way of background, Your Honor.
Well, if the man either gave a an affirmative response that he could be fair or was silent, would not everyone in the courtroom have a right to assume that he was stating he could be fair?
It's the only reason I raise that point. I agree, Your Honor. The only reason I raise that point is because counsel seems to imply that we have to show a mental positive bias or prejudice on the part of that juror. And we suggest that the right to know, such as in the Swain case and other cases by this court, in the peremptory setting, is totally different from the misconduct involved after a jury commences to deliberate, or where there's outside influence or threatened the right to know full and complete answers is important subjectively to the trial lawyer in trying to decide how to unselect three whom he might think would be the three worst jurors for him.
Well, how far does that go? For instance, suppose you had a juror who simply didn't want to tell his or her true age and lied about it on voir dire. Are we going to give you a new trial because you didn't know how old that juror was? No.
In our case, the Tenth Circuit said that's de minimis. It has to be sufficient cogency and substantially effect. See, the important thing about this case,
counsel,
to us,
before you proceed, there were other defendants, weren't they, in addition to the...
No.
None whatever?
No other defendants.
The $350,000 damages was assessed against whom?
Well, the mother of the little boy who lost both his feet.
Was she a defendant?
No, but in Kansas, we have a unique procedure whereby the defendant can name phantom parties and blame other persons, not parties to the case.
Wasn't the neighbor...
Beg your pardon?
Wasn't the neighbor a phantom defendant?
The neighbor's father and the boy driving the mower, as well as the little boy's mother, were all found to be at fault by the jury in some percentage.
Yes, the jury brought in, what, $350,000 damages against those
$375,000, I believe. But that was after the juror first went out and found zero, and the court sent them back and said, you must find damages.
My question is, how could there have been bias if the jury found no negligence on the part of the manufacturer of the bicycle and then found negligence on the part of other people and assessed damages?
Because in Kansas, there is no joint and several liability.
None whatever.
None whatever. And so therefore...
Been two manufacturers.
Beg your pardon, sir?
Suppose it had been two manufacturers. Somebody had manufactured parts and somebody else had manufactured other parts.
In Kansas, the defendant only pays his percentage share that is found against him or it and nothing else. If a defendant is found to be 10%, he pays 10% of the total damages award. That is, if he's a party. If he's found to have 20% and he's a non-party, he still pays zero. So doing away with joint and several under Kansas substantive law has had a great effect upon these cases. But the significance is that this juror, had he answered, yes, I've had a son who was injured in an exploding rim case.
Your question was a serious injury, not just injury. Wasn't that your question on voir dire?
Serious injury causing disability or prolonged pain or suffering. Now, this becomes more important as in response to Chief Justice Berger's question, because other questions were asked by my court, by myself, and by counsel, where people were talked about their sons getting a finger in a bike. Very insignificant kind of questions, because in my experience in 27 years, you will find jurors fully and openly resolve all doubts about answering questions in favor of responding. This is the first time in my experience as a lawyer that anybody's ever withheld something in the general area where other jurors are responding. A lady was stuck or got in a wringer washer 15 years before or 20 years before the man married her, and another minor injury to a child 13, all happening many years before.
You really don't know, do you, unless you investigate all the jurors after their answers. You know that some respond. You're not sure the ones who aren't responding may not have had similar experience.
See, this case is kind of a freak because we first filed our first motion to ask to waive the rule under just cause and say we've got just cause to talk to these jurors under the waiving the Kansas rule, because one juror who was an alternate had the audacity after the case was over to run to the judge, talk to the defense lawyer, and come to the plaintiff leaving the courtroom saying, how much is Schroer getting paid for contingent fees in this case? How do you solicit this case? What kind of a plaintiff's lawyer is he? What's the effect upon insurance? So our first motion was directed at the kind of misconduct that counsel's talking about, where the first juror influenced maybe. And we says, that's just cause, Judge. Let us talk to the jury. The second one came about accidentally and coincidentally because the plaintiff was a recruiter. And across his desk come the application for the Navy from the son of the jury foreman saying that he had been injured and suffered broken bones by an exploding rim while working at a truck stop. It's a comparable products liability case. Now, the point as far as the plaintiff's voir dire is concerned is that information would have been important to me to ask follow-up questions had he responded truthfully or fully. And I think the Tenth Circuit said it doesn't make any difference whether it was truthful. It wasn't full. It wasn't. He didn't fully respond to the kind of questions an average juror would have.
Mr. Shook, how long did this trial last? Do you remember?
I believe it was 8 trial days.
Supposing instead
weekend
of eight,
was involved.
Supposing it was instead of 8 trial days, it had been 8 trial months. Would you still 8 trial months the trial had gone on? Would you still say that an error like this described by the Court of Appeals would require a new trial and the reassembling of all the judicial machinery to take another 8 months?
I would, Your Honor, because I think that, as Justice White said in the Swain case, this is a very important right, the peremptory right, to be exercised with knowledge and with truth and arbitrarily by the that may not be the exact word in the opinion, but the right of the lawyers. And this court has even held where courts have restricted that right of information or not asked, allowed questions to be asked on peremptory or not asked questions which the lawyers requested, that affected the right of peremptory, the use of the peremptory statute.
Surely no right is absolute. I mean, there must be an interest in the finality of jury verdicts to a certain extent.
That's right. And I agree, Your Honor, and that's why the Tenth Circuit said if it's de minimis, like the lady with the $100 case or the case where the lawyer didn't ask the question, it was so vague, the circuit case so vague that the jury didn't understand the question, it can't be reversed on those grounds. But it's where it's substantial or where a reasonable juror would give this kind of information that a lawyer is entitled to know so that he might ask follow-up questions. See, any juror who kind of says accidents are a part of life and my kids all have accidents and has that kind of cavalier attitude isn't a good juror for a plaintiff in a products liability case. And I would have considered that information.
A severe remedy for whatever happened here. It's just an assumption by the Court of Appeals that your peremptory challenge right was substantially interfered with. Shouldn't there have been a hearing on it before a district court?
We asked for 2 hearings. We were refused. We alleged a motion for new trial. The court's refusal, asked for argument, asked to subpoena jurors again in a motion for a new trial.
I understand that the contents of this telephone conversation with the juror never came to the attention of the trial judge.
Well, if Your Honor, in the appendix, the motion for a new trial was mailed the 4th. The judge got it the 5th.
Right.
The same day as his order came out allowing us to make a brief and polite phone call.
Yes.
Can Your Honor understand, as a officer of that court, with the attitude of a strict trial judge, saying brief and polite, we had about a 2-minute conversation, which he said those things that are agreed to in the record, which doesn't show basic, I shouldn't say basic misconduct or prejudice, but it shows information that I would have liked to consider in making my 3 selections.
Well, yeah, but I'm talking about the Court of Appeals. Do you think the Court of Appeals should have told the trial judge to hold a hearing rather than order a new trial?
The dissent did.
Well, the dissent, but how about the majority? The majority ordered a new trial, and I suppose you're here. Are you here defending that or not?
I'm here defending that, sir.
When did you tell the district judge about this hearing? This telephone conversation
in
relation to the motion for a new trial.
The motion for a new trial on page 60 only informs the court and the affidavits, the 2 affidavits.
Well, that contained the information that you had found.
That was not my
question. Specific information was not communicated to the trial court because we believed that we were prevented from making a record by the trial court, and we believed that the trial court should have let us, on motion for a new trial, bring the juror in, and we believe...
Did you ask the trial judge for that?
Yes. Yes, on page 94 of the appendix, we request oral argument and request the court subpoena the jurors. We felt that that point...
That does not say about the telephone conversation.
You're correct, Your Honor. The specifics...
Why didn't you tell him about the telephone conversation? Why? W-H-Y.
All right, sir. The reason we didn't, in all honesty, sir, is because we felt that that was what we were going to bring up on motion for new trial.
Weren't you just as guilty of withholding information from the judge as you alleged the juror was withholding information from you?
I hope not, sir. I hope not.
Counsel?
The Kansas rule is kind of unique because when we filed our first motions for just cause, as the rule provides, the court responded there was no concrete evidence. Well, we didn't attempt to reach a threshold and should have been required under the Kansas rule to reach a threshold of no concrete evidence. We merely had to show just cause why the court should have allowed the jurors to be brought in under oath with a record and examined, not with regard to prejudice, but with regard to whether or not they withheld information necessary for the right of the exercise of the peremptory challenges. And I think the circuit cases that I've looked at, there's only one that I think disagrees with our premise.
Counsel, before you proceed, let's assume that when you had this conversation with the juror who had remained silent, he said, yes, I did have a son who had an accident that hurt his leg rather badly, and we did bring suit and we won a $500,000 judgment. But I thought this was just information that might prejudice one side or the other, so I kept quiet. What would your position be?
Okay. That's an excellent question. May I also assume, Your Honor, the jury went the other way and decided for the plaintiff?
Well.
You see, that's the significance.
Yes, but I'm assuming you lost the case. What's your answer?
My answer is, as an officer of the court with defendant there, I would have to agree with his oral integrity. I mean, I'd have to, as a basis of integrity,
you'd
agree
still be
with
here. You'd still be here today?
Would I still be here today?
Well, if, I'm assuming you lost all the
way. The Tenth Circuit would have, under the previous cases, would have said, go back for a new trial.
It would have? The Tenth Circuit says you have a right to know. Would the Tenth Circuit have reversed the case?
Well, if I understand your assumption correctly, the Tenth Circuit in these three cases, two preceding this one, have all reversed cases, one by the plaintiff, where the defendant has appealed because somebody didn't mention about an injury case or a trial that they were involved in.
How could you have been prejudiced if the juror had withheld the information that his son had recovered $500,000?
Well, I couldn't have been.
Of course not.
That's right. And
but
there are cases...
Prejudice is immaterial, is it?
I couldn't have been prejudiced. There's a case in the circuit where a juror that had not answered questions about him being a defendant in a case. And the plaintiff won. And the defendant then claimed error because the defendant didn't tell about his being a defendant in the case. And the circuit said, no, it didn't work against you, so there's no error there, you see. I don't know how I can impress an argument.
But on the facts of this case, supposing you had gotten the judgment and precisely the same information was developed that's been developed here, namely the foreman didn't disclose the injury to his son, would the defendant be entitled to a new trial on these facts?
I think so. Because
either side could have set aside a verdict in this case.
Based upon our theory that both lawyers have a right to know this information about a person's attitude toward bringing cases and filing
suit. Let me ask one other mechanical question, if I may. There were 12 people who were interrogated on the voir dire, 12 potential jurors, and six were excused on the peremptory by using each used three peremptories. No one used any challenges for cause, is that correct?
No, sir.
So that those 12 were the only 12 that were ever asked this question.
This could have developed information that would have been a challenge for cause that allowed us another peremptory, but I don't know that at this point. The significance to us, and I think the Tenth Circuit and the other circuits are all in agreement except for one case in the Fifth, the Zenza case, I think all agree there is a distinction between misconduct of the jury and the kind of prejudice necessary after the jury becomes a jury and the kind of information that the plaintiff or the defendant is entitled to as a matter of right to exercise arbitrary or capricious or hunch or belief challenges.
Let me ask one other question about the facts here. Where can we find out how serious this boy's injury was? I know it was a broken leg and it was a result of a tire exploding. Well, what more do we know about it?
Well, now we get into memory again.
Does the record tell us?
Counsel's memory and notes are a little different from mine.
Well, but what is now in writing that we could look at other than asking your personal recollection of the conversation?
There are our recollections that are in the record on the appeal to the Tenth Circuit where counsel agrees with them.
By saying in the record, you mean in the briefs?
In the appendix, yes, and in the briefs it's referred to. And counsel's recollection has a couple of phrases in addition to our recollection. The important thing that we were ordered to be brief, and the call was so short, I didn't feel, as an officer of court, I could push it any further. And I felt that the fact that he admitted that he didn't give information he knew about and was aware of, because actions are part of life, and that kind of cavalier attitude, I thought should have been enough for the trial court to have granted a motion for a new trial or at least held a hearing, letting us subpoena the jurors and letting us establish not bias and not prejudice.
Now, let me ask one other question. You say that should have been enough for the trial judge. Now, did you have an oral argument on the motion for new trial?
He refused to allow oral argument. We asked for it. It was not allowed.
And you never submitted in writing to him what you thought should have been enough?
Well, I didn't submit the specifics of the word conversation.
Well, you never told him anything about the telephone conversation. You didn't have an oral argument, so you didn't tell him orally, and you didn't file anything in writing other than what's already been called to our attention.
That's correct. We felt precluded from making a decent record, and we didn't feel if the court wouldn't find just cause to let us examine a juror, he sure wouldn't believe oral conversations or attorneys' mental
well,
processes.
Well, the Court of Appeals didn't think you had been remiss at all.
No, sir. No, sir.
They gave you relief.
That's right, sir.
They didn't think you had passed up any opportunity you had in the trial court.
That's correct, sir. And I think that's very significant because they say that the important thing is would a reasonable juror have responded, and if a reasonable juror would have responded, then the plaintiff was entitled under the statute to have that kind of response from this juror, and the failure of his giving that response affected my right to peremptory challenge, and that right to peremptory challenge would indicate, or that also would indicate, implied bias.
Well, Mr. Schroer, you're not indicating or contending, I guess, that the information disclosed here would have entitled that the juror be excused for cause, are you?
We didn't know. We didn't get to ask
him
enough
questions.
You
know it or not, we know now. You're not contending that that's sufficient to have the juror excused for cause, are you?
By itself, no.
Okay.
But the follow-up questions may have developed an attitude by him that the court would have excluded for cause. That's my point. We didn't get to follow up and say, why do you feel that accidents are part of life? And why do you feel everybody has accidents? And why do you think that it's not important?
Well, I guess
important?
You could have asked questions like that of all the jurors as you went along, and you probably typically do, don't you?
We asked
juror attitudes.
What we did is we asked the general question. And then if you get responses, as counsel did, then there are follow-up questions. And in fact, counsel asked two or three follow-up questions on accidents and injuries after I finished. And that's when some jurors responded to some de minimis type of events that happened many years ago. And what I'm suggesting is, had this juror have responded, both myself and skilled counsel for the defendant would have inquired about his attitudes. You just can't ask somebody directly, are you prejudiced?
Yes, but some of that is present in every jury selection in America. There are things that some jurors disclose and some that others do not. And if one does, you're likely to follow up. And if one doesn't, you don't.
That's right.
And you have to be very careful in fashioning a rule for a new trial that you don't go too far in presuming things. You might be wearing the other shoe at the next trial and be resisting this very thing.
I agree. And there's a good amicus brief in this case filed by Southern Union Company where the defense, the shoe was on the other foot, But the Tenth Circuit said it can be de minimis and can be unimportant. Like, for example, if someone says, I've got six kids and he had seven kids, or many other. There's a Tenth Circuit case where someone took out about a $100 settlement. They said that's de minimis. The question is whether
maybe
it's substantial.
What's important is whether it indicates a probable bias.
That's right.
Is that the test?
Well,
whether the responses would indicate a probable
whether
bias?
Whether a probable bias can be implied sufficient so that counsel, with the right to full information under the statute, could use a peremptory or not use a peremptory, but needs that information to exercise his right of peremptory. It's the
okay,
basic
but you
issue.
Would, you would agree that the information that isn't disclosed should at least be something that would indicate probable bias?
Subjectively, because of the rule Mr. Patterson points out, you can't go in to the jury and say, now, after even if you have them under oath, and say, are you biased? Nobody admits to bias, and there's language in all your cases which say that it has to be a state of mind that can't be definitively proven.
Mr. Schroer, how many peremptories do you have in Kansas?
Three.
On page 64 of the joint appendix, there seem to be eight strikes.
Okay.
And who are the other two?
Let me mention it. After the six are impaneled, the juror says, now, we're going to select two alternates, and you will each be given another peremptory challenge. And so after the sixth jury was selected, two alternates were selected, and we were each given another peremptory challenge just on the alternates.
But it doesn't show who exercised.
We each exercised one.
Yes, but it doesn't show who struck Max Frauenfelder or Albert Elser. It's probably of no significance.
I don't remember. One of those alternates was.
Just have the sheet and pass it back and forth.
That's exactly right, sir. And there's no such thing as only exercising two peremptories, because when you got 12 in the box, you each have to take your three. And that's the way we do it in the District of Kansas. And it works. And I want to say that the jury system works. And the free exercise of peremptory. Beg your pardon, sir?
I thought you said this case was a freak.
I don't think
I'm saying this is normal in Kansas.
I don't think I said this case was a freak. If I did, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that it was a freak. I said it was unusual because the accidental way.
Now you're saying it's usual. Now you're saying this is a very good thing in Kansas. It works beautifully.
I do think the jury system works beautifully, but there's no such thing that works beautifully every time. I'm suggesting that the rule which keeps us from talking to jurors is one thing, and maybe a good rule.
Was the record in this case opened in the Court of Appeals?
Beg your pardon, sir?
Was the record opened and this material put in it? What I want to know is how it got in the record.
How what got in the record, sir?
The telephone conversation, et cetera.
It was in the abstract agreed to by counsel and in the both briefs to the Court of Appeals.
But I said, where was it in the record?
It was not in the record.
Well, how in the world can we pass on it?
Because it's been stipulated
to be correct. You can't stipulate a record, can you?
Well, I guess I would only say, Your Honor, is that we feel we were prohibited from making a proper record by the trial court.
And where do you want us to make the record?
Your Honor, I don't know that I understand what you're asking me. There's a problem with the record, and we believe that we were prohibited from making that record by the trial court's refusal to let us bring the jurors in and examine them on the record and under oath.
And
we had no other alternative.
How did we do it other than to send it back to the district court?
Yeah. I wanted to mention that in argument. There were several other issues in the Tenth Circuit that were not decided. And they were not mentioned. And I would cite Jackson, the Second Circuit case of 1968, where the circuit court stated that the view we've taken of Juror Kemper's disqualification precludes the need to deal with other points raised by the appellant. There are serious other points in this case. The court has three alternatives, I suppose. One is to, I think, is to, if you agree with counsel for the petitioner, to send it back to the Tenth Circuit and say, decide these other issues you didn't mention, because you can't just leave them hanging. A second choice would be to send it back to the trial court and have a hearing on whether or not this untruthful or not full or not complete response to the question affected, in the trial court's mind, our right to the statutory peremptory challenges and the right to have full information to base that one on. We think that those are the only two alternatives, except to affirm the circuit court's, which we would respectfully suggest should be done, because the circuit court said, in this case, the kind of misinformation or non-information rises to a level that it can be judged by an appellate court to be so important that it affected the right to peremptory by the mere nature of it.
How did you say how the $375,000 award was assessed against whom?
It was assessed against the parties or the non-parties
by name.
Liable. The mother of the little boy, Mrs. Greenwood, the jury put 35% on her because the little boy was outside playing in a neighbor's, in a dead-end street, and the boy driving the mower got 25 or something, and the father of the boy who owned the mower got 45%. So the defendant, what we contend was a defective manufacturer, zero.
And what the Court of Appeals do about that allocation?
A new trial is a new trial on all the issues. They won't reallocate that. They remitted it for a new trial.
And again, if there's an award, it may be allocated the same way if the jury wants to. Is that it?
It's possible that it could be.
I mean, 35, 15, 45?
What's interesting, I've never seen this before, and I want to say just quickly, the Tenth Circuit said, We emphasize that plaintiff's cause of action is not a groundless one. The district court found plaintiff's evidence sufficiently substantial to justify submission on the theory of liability to the jury. We're therefore satisfied that our remand for new trial is not an exercise in futility. That's a footnote after they state reverse remand.
Which means that McDonough may be, on a new trial, assessed damages.
I think that it should, that very likely that would be the result of a new trial, Your Honor.
Who's your part?
Billy Greenwood, a little boy who lost 2 feet
right.
Because of a defective power mower.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything further, Mr. Patterson?
Very briefly, Your Honor. I have a fear that we're losing perspective on how these various issues fit together. The purpose of a hearing, I believe, is to determine whether or not there is anything other than harmless error once you reach the conclusion that a right was denied. But the underlying problem is whether or not there was a right denied. Was there a right to know and possess information above that which was provided by good faith, honest answers of jurors? That, to me, is the fundamental and the pivotal
but counsel, question. Can we be entirely sure? Everybody assumed for purpose of the decision it was a good faith, honest answer. But is it not possible that a hearing would disclose that the juror did, in fact, was less than candid? I have to confess, I'm not. I would have thought most people would have answered this question differently.
Well, I suppose that would have to be a question that would be answered by the trial court, but the standard would be misconduct. Now, that's something else.
You think it is the same standard of misconduct before the jury is selected as it would be after the jury is selected? He makes quite a point of the fact that you're talking about the process of selecting jurors, not what you do to jurors after selected.
Well, I don't know as it would. Prior to the time the case is tried, of course, the standard is whether or not there's cause. Challenge for cause. That, of course, is a judgment call of the trial court. But
see, it interests me that Judge Barrett's position was that the case should have gone back and you should have had a hearing to find out a little bit more about the facts, and we're all kind of troubled by our inability to know exactly what they were.
Judge Barrett's decision was to this effect, as I comprehend it. There was a denial of a right,
but was it anything other? Was it prejudicial? Was it bias? Send it back for a hearing to determine that. Our position here is all three. Was there a denial of a right? And if so, is it necessary to resolve the question of the consequence of that denial by a hearing by the trial judge?
Well, would you take the same position if the juror's son had a permanent injury as a result of the tire explosion?
Well, that would certainly make a harder case. Our recollection, we have very little information about it, as counsel stated, and I'll confess that.
Well, what if he was out for 6 months? He had to miss 6 months of school.
That would certainly come closer to a case of juror misconduct.
And the problem is we really don't know exactly what the facts are.
That's right. That would come far closer to a case of juror misconduct. But you see, what makes this such a dangerous rule is that the Tenth Circuit acknowledged he was honest and in good faith, but they're still entitled to this information level, but they give us no way by which this information could be obtained.
I'm just wondering, to get the last one, I'm sorry to take so much of your rebuttal time, but what is your position with respect to the soundness of Judge Barrett's position? Do you think Judge Barrett was right or wrong?
Part of each. On the question of whether or not a denial of a right had a consequence other than harmless error requiring a hearing, yes, he's right. It should not be concluded that it was anything other than harmless error. That is, it should not be concluded that there was bias or that there was prejudice in the absence of a hearing. But on the initial step, that there was a denial of a level of information to which he was entitled, no, we disagree. You see, the Tenth Circuit says that that right exists, but how is it obtained? They're silent on that. If we were to try the case again, what would we do differently? What would the trial judge do differently? We're at a loss. I submit that we would have to do it exactly the same way. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in